Chapter 11. Whatever, but this is an impression which is hardly to be believed at this distance of years. What I am certain of is that I was very far from thinking of writing a story, though it is possible, and even likely, that I was thinking of the man Elmayer. I had seen him for the first time, some 4 years before, from the bridge of a steamer moored to a rickety little wharf 40 miles up, more or less, a Bornean river. It was very early morning, and a slight mist, an opaline mist as in Bessborough Gardens, only without the fiery flicks on roof and chimney pot from the rays of the red London sun, promised to turn presently into a woolly fog. Barring a small dugout canoe on the river, there was nothing moving within sight. I had just come up yawning from my cabin. The Serang and the Malay crew were overhauling the cargo chains and trying the winches. Their voices sounded subdued on the deck below, and their movements were languid. That tropical daybreak was chilly. The Malay quartermaster, coming up to get something from the lockers on the bridge, shivered visibly. The forests above and below and on the opposite bank looked black and dank. Wet dripped from the rigging upon the tightly stretched deck awnings, and it was in the middle of a shuddering yawn that I caught sight of Elmayer. He was moving across a patch of burned grass, a blurred, shadowy shape with the blurred bulk of a house behind him, a low house of mats, bamboos, and palm leaves, with a high-pitched roof of grass. He stepped upon the jetty. He was clad simply in flapping pajamas of cretonne pattern, enormous flowers with yellow petals on a disagreeable blue ground, and a thin cotton singlet with short sleeves. His arms, bare to the elbow, were crossed on his chest. His black hair looked as if it had not been cut for a very long time, and a curly wisp of it strayed across his forehead. I had heard of him at Singapore. I had heard of him on board. I had heard of him early in the morning and late at night. I had heard of him at tiffin and at dinner. I had heard of him in a place called Pillow Lot from a half-caste gentleman there, who described himself as the manager of a coal mine, which sounded civilized and progressive till you heard that the mine could not be worked at present, because it was haunted by some particularly atrocious ghosts. I had heard of him in a place called Dongola, in the island of Celebes, when the Raja of that little known seaport, you can get no anchorage there in less than 15 fathom, which is extremely inconvenient, came on board in a friendly way, with only 2 attendants, and drank bottle after bottle of soda water on the after skylight with my good friend and commander, Captain C. At least I heard his name distinctly pronounced several times in a lot of talk in Malay language. Oh, yes, I heard it quite distinctly. Elmayer, Elmayer, and saw Captain C smile, while the fat, dingy Raja laughed audibly. To hear a Malay Raja laugh outright is a rare experience, I can assure you. And I overheard more of Elmayer's name among our deck passengers, mostly wandering traders of good repute, as they sat all over the ship, each man fenced round with bundles and boxes on mats, on pillows, on quilts, on billets of wood, conversing of island affairs. Upon my word, I heard the mutter of Elmayer's name faintly at midnight, while making my way aft from the bridge, to look at the patent taffrail log tinkling its quarter miles in the great silence of the sea. I don't mean to say that our passengers dreamed aloud of Elmayer, but it is indubitable that 2 of them at least, who could not sleep, apparently, and were trying to charm away the trouble of insomnia by a little whispered talk at that ghostly hour, were referring in some way or other to Elmayer. It was really impossible on board that ship to get away definitely from Elmayer, and a very small pony tied up forward, and whisking its tail inside the galley, to the great embarrassment of our Chinaman cook, was destined for Elmayer. What he wanted with a pony, goodness only knows, since I am perfectly certain he could not ride it. But here you have the man, ambitious, aiming at the grandiose, importing a pony, whereas in the whole settlement at which he used to shake daily his impotent fist there was only one path that was practicable for a pony. A quarter of a mile at most, hedged in by hundreds of square leagues of virgin forest. But who knows? The importation of that Balai pony might have been part of some deep scheme, of some diplomatic plan, of some hopeful intrigue. With Almayer one could never tell. He governed his conduct by considerations removed from the obvious, by incredible assumptions, which rendered his logic impenetrable to any reasonable person. I learned all this later. That morning, seeing the figure in pajamas moving in the mist, I said to myself, that's the man. He came quite close to the ship's side, and raised a harassed countenance, round and flat, with that curl of black hair over the forehead and a heavy, pained glance. Good morning. Good morning. He looked hard at me. I was a new face, having just replaced the chief mate he was accustomed to see. And I think that this novelty inspired him, as things generally did, with deep-seated mistrust. Didn't expect you till this evening, he remarked, suspiciously. I didn't know why he should have been aggrieved, but he seemed to be. I took pains to explain to him that, having picked up the beacon at the mouth of the river just before dark and the tide serving, Captain C was enabled to cross the bar, and there was nothing to prevent him going up the river at night. Captain C knows this river like his own pocket, I concluded, discursively, trying to get on terms. Better, said Almayer. Leaning over the rail of the bridge, I looked at Almayer, who looked down at the wharf in aggrieved thought. He shuffled his feet a little, he wore straw slippers with thick soles. The morning fog had thickened considerably. Everything round us dripped the derricks, the rails, every single rope in the ship, as if a fit of crying had come upon the universe. Almayer again raised his head, and, in the accents of a man accustomed to the buffets of evil fortune, asked, hardly audibly, I suppose you haven't got such a thing as a pony on board? I told him, almost in a whisper, for he attuned my communications to his minor key, that we had such a thing as a pony, and I hinted, as gently as I could, that he was confoundedly in the way too. I was very anxious to have him landed, before I began to handle the cargo. Almayer remained looking up at me for a long while, with incredulous and melancholy eyes, as though it were not a safe thing, to believe in my statement. This pathetic mistrust in the favorable issue of any sort of affair touched me deeply, and I added, he doesn't seem a bit the worse for the passage. He's a nice pony too. Almayer was not to be cheered up. For all answer he cleared his throat, and looked down again at his feet. I tried to close with him on another tack. By Jove! I said. Aren't you afraid of catching pneumonia or bronchitis or something, walking about in a singlet in such a wet fog? He was not to be propitiated by a show of interest in his health. His answer was a sinister oh fear, as much as to say that even that way of escape from inclement fortune was close to him. I just came down. Dottie mumbled after a while. Well then, now you're here I will land that pony for you at once, and you can lead him home. I really don't want him on deck. He's in the way. Almayer seemed doubtful. I insisted. Why, I will just swing him out, and land him on the wharf right in front of you. I'd much rather do it before the hatches are off. The little devil may jump down the hold, or do some other deadly thing. There's a halter, postulated Almayer. Yes, of course there's a halter. And without waiting any more I leaned over the bridge rail. Sarang, land to an Almayer's pony. The cook hastened to shut the door of the galley, and a moment later a great scuffle began on deck. The pony kicked with extreme energy, the calashes skipped out of the way, the Sarang issued many orders in a cracked voice. Suddenly the pony leaped upon the fore hatch. His little hoofs thundered tremendously. He plunged and reared. He had tossed his mane and his forelock into a state of amazing wildness. He dilated his nostrils. Bits of foam flecked his broad little chest. His eyes blazed. He was something under 11 hands. He was fierce, terrible, angry, warlike. He said ha, ha. Distinctly, he raged and thumped and 16 able-bodied calashes stood round him like disconcerted nurses round a spoiled and passionate child. He whisked his tail incessantly, He arched his pretty neck. He was perfectly delightful. He was charmingly naughty. There was not an atom of vice in that performance. No savage baring of teeth and laying back of ears. On the contrary, he pricked them forward in a comically aggressive manner. He was totally unmoral and lovable. I would have liked to give him bread, sugar, carrots. But life is a stern thing, and the sense of duty the only safe guide. So I steeled my heart, and from my elevated position on the bridge I ordered the men to fling themselves upon him in a body. The elderly Serang, emitting a strange, inarticulate cry, gave the example. He was an excellent petty officer, very competent, indeed, and a moderate opium smoker. The rest of them in one great rush smothered that pony. They hung on to his ears, to his mane, to his tail. They lay in piles across his back, 17 in all. The carpenter, seizing the hook of the cargo chain, flung himself on the top of them. A very satisfactory petty officer too, but he stuttered. Have you ever heard a light yellow, lean, sad earnest Chinaman stutter in pidgin English? It's very weird, indeed. He made the 18th. I could not see the pony at all, but from the swaying and heaving of that heap of men I knew that there was something alive inside. From the wharf Almayer hailed, in quavering tones. Oh, I say. Where he stood he could not see what was going on deck, unless, perhaps, the tops of the men's heads. He could only hear the scuffle, the mighty thuds, as if the ship were being knocked to pieces. I looked over Colin, what is it? Don't let them break his legs, he entreated me, plaintively. Oh, nonsense. He's all right now. He can't move. By that time the cargo chain had been hooked to the broad canvas belt round the pony's body. The calashes sprang off simultaneously in all directions, rolling over each other, and the worthy Serang, making a dash behind the winch, turned the steam on. Steady! I yelled, in great apprehension of seeing the animal snatched up to the very head of the derrick. On the wharf Almayer shuffled his straw slippers uneasily. The rattle of the winch stopped, and in a tense, impressive silence that pony began to swing across the deck. How limp he was! Directly he felt himself in the air he relaxed every muscle in a most wonderful manner. His four hoofs knocked together in a bunch, his head hung down, and his tail remained pendant in a nerveless and absolute immobility. He reminded me vividly of the pathetic little sheep which hangs on the collar of the Order of the Golden Fleece. I had no idea that anything in the shape of a horse could be so limp as that, either living or dead. His wild mane hung down lumpily, a mere mass of inanimate horsehair. His aggressive ears had collapsed, but as he went swaying slowly across the front of the bridge I noticed an astute gleam in his dreamy, half-closed eye. A trustworthy quartermaster, his glance anxious and his mouth on the broad grin, was easing over the derrick watchfully. I superintended, greatly interested. So, that will do. The derrick had stopped. The calashes lined the rail. The rope of the halter hung perpendicular and motionless like a bell pull in front of Almayer. Everything was very still. I suggested amicably that he should catch hold of the rope and mind what he was about. He extended a provokingly casual and superior hand. Look out, then. Lower away. Almayer gathered in the rope intelligently enough, but when the pony's hoofs touched the wharf he gave way all at once to a most foolish optimism. Without pausing, without thinking, almost without looking, he disengaged the hook suddenly from the sling, and the cargo chain, after hitting the pony's quarters, swung back against the ship's side with a noisy, rattling slap. I suppose I must have blinked. I know I missed something, because the next thing I saw was Almayer lying flat on his back on the jetty. He was alone. Astonishment deprived me of speech long enough to give Almayer time to pick himself up in a leisurely and painful manner. The calashes lining the rail all had their mouths open. The mist flew in the light breeze, and it had come over quite thick enough to hide the shore completely. How on earth did you manage to let him get away? I asked, scandalized. Almayer looked into the smarting palm of his right hand, but did not answer my inquiry. Where do you think he will get to? I cried. Are there any fences anywhere in this fog? Can he bolt into the forest? What's to be done now? Almayer shrugged his shoulders. Some of my men are sure to be about. They will get hold of him sooner or later. Sooner or later. That's all very fine, but what about my canvas sling? He's carried it off. I want it now, at once, to land two Celeb's cows. Since Dongola, we had on board a pair of the pretty little island cattle in addition to the pony. Tied up on the other side of the foredeck, they had been whisking their tails into the other door of the galley. These cows were not for Almayer, however. They were in this to Abdullah bin Salem, his enemy. Almayer's disregard of my requirements was complete. If I were you, I would try to find out where he's gone, I insisted. Ad, you better call your men together or something. He will throw himself down and cut his knees. He may even break a leg, you know. But Almayer, plunged in abstracted thought, did not seem to want. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.